It is Friday, October the 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Russian airstrikes in Syria and impact on the Islamic State militants.
Could very well then mean that Islamic State could very well take advantage of this position and move in areas which have now been vacated or weakened because of the Russian attacks.
Also ahead, repartitioning in South Sudan, plus a world-renowned cellist turning 60. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, ahead of a meeting of alliance defense ministers in Brussels, said they will discuss what he calls Russia's troubling escalation of military activity in Syria. Russia's first airstrikes were launched on September the 30th, and Stoltenberg says even Russian incursions into Turkish airspace, NATO is able and ready to defend all allies, including Turkey, against any threat. Ankara is a member of that alliance, and the NATO leader says the situation is being assessed constantly. Stoltenberg's remarks follow Russia's use of shipborne cruise missiles for the first time this week to attack what Moscow calls Islamic State targets. Meanwhile, Syrian troops, with backing from Russian warplanes and Iranian-backed Hezbollah militia, launched an offensive aimed at opposition forces in western Syria. Turkey's prime minister has said only two of Russia's airstrikes have been aimed at IS targets. And here in Washington, U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby said Russia's intervention has done little to bring the nearly five-year conflict to an end.
What Russian military activity has done, or has the potential to do, is to exacerbate the conflict already ongoing inside Syria along sectarian lines. And as we've said before, that if there's a constructive role to be had by Russia against ISIL, then that's a conversation we're willing to have. I don't think we're at that point right now, given what they're hitting and what they're choosing to do with their military forces. But if what they're doing, and certainly if you look just intrinsically at where they're striking and who they're going after, certainly would lead one to conclude that what they're trying to do is to prop up the Assad regime. All that's going to do is prolong the conflict. In fact, make it worse. And that is not something that we're interested in furthering and having a dialogue in terms of Russian future activity.
Kirby also said no decision has been made on establishing a no-fly zone along the Turkish-Syria border. Regional analyst Zubair Iqbal, a scholar at the Washington-based Mideast Institute, told VOA's Victor Beatty Russia's objectives in Syria have not changed.
The whole purpose was eliminate all opposition to the Assad government, strengthen Assad government's position, and then, from position of strength, negotiate, if necessary, in Geneva. While the intention is to strengthen the hands of the Assad government, at the same time, the Russians are trying to send a message. The message is, we have now come back to a position of strength where we can attack positions from this far away, and we are willing and able to take the chances and the risks that are required to do it. So we have to look at it in a much wider sense than just looking at it from a narrow Syrian point of view. I concede and I agree that the purpose there clearly was soften up the fixed positions of the opposition, including of Islamic State, and then move in. But remember, Idlib and Amma are not necessarily places where the ISIS or the Islamic State is highly concentrated. It is really the other opposition groups which are concentrated. The point is, weaken them, and after you have weakened them and have forced them to combine and join with the Assad government position, then go after the Islamic State. It's a very risky proposition.
Is that going to unravel U.S. policy of backing these anti-Assad opposition fighters?
The realities on the ground are much more complex today than they were, say, 2 weeks ago. One of the important things is that the position of the opposition, especially the secular opposition and the opposition which could call the moderate opposition, has been weakened. And at this stage, they are not being provided the adequate military and political support that is needed for them to withstand it. which could very well then mean that Islamic State could very well take advantage of this position and move in areas which have now been vacated or weakened because of the Russian attacks. So we have to see how things go. It's all very confusing, all very complex at this moment. But what we can say, though, is that the Russians and their supporters of the Assad government have moved with a resolute force. Whether that turns out to be the right thing to do and whether it brings about what they expect it to bring about is anybody's guess. But my concern in this is the following. In case this fails, then we have a much more serious problem on our hands where the international intervention will have been considered as futile, as useless, and under those circumstances, the Islamic State's hand will be strengthened.
Turkey's airspace has been violated a number of times by Russian warplanes. How alarmed is Turkey?
Very alarmed, and for two reasons. One of those is, of course, that their territory and their sovereignty has been violated. But other thing which one has to be very careful about is the following. Turkey depends up to 50% of its gas needs, natural gas needs, from Russia. If it creates a situation where Russia and the conflict between Russia and Turkey takes place, then Turkey could potentially lose access, if not all, a part of that gas, the same way as Russia played its hands and its cards in the case of Ukraine. So under those circumstances, Turkey has to be very careful. And that would imply that it may actually play a much more cautious game than one would have expected Turkey to do.
Zubair says Russian backing should help improve both morale and recruiting for the Syrian army, which up to now has been on the defensive. He says if the army improves, it will likely mean the need for using Russian ground troops in the form of advisors and volunteers will lessen. Now it's time to look at online reaction to the Russian airstrikes aimed at Syria. And as always, our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, is here with the latest. Hey, G., what's the U.S. reaction to all of this?
Hi, Steve. We just heard from John Kirby, the State Department spokesperson, and the U.S. Embassy in Syria is tweeting his quotes. The embassy is on Twitter at U.S. Embassy Syria and sent out two tweets quoting Kirby. The first one reads like this. Over 90% of the strikes that we have seen Russians take to date have not been against ISIL or Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists. Here's a second tweet. Russian strikes have been largely against opposition groups that want a better future for Syria and don't want to see Assad regime in power.
Gee, and what about Kirby himself? Did he tweet anything?
No, surprisingly, he didn't. He's on Twitter at StateDPTSPOX, but hasn't been tweeting in the last couple of days.
Well, I see. Well, it seems like the U.S. government is showing stronger positions against the Russian military action in Syria. Any other tweets, G?
That seems to be the case. Some politicians are still quite upset with what they perceive as lukewarm or slow response from Washington, and Senator John McCain is definitely one of them.
And a pretty vocal one, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Now, as you know, he's a war veteran, and his parents also served in the military, so he's very passionate about defense issues. He sent out two tweets about the incident, and here's one. U.S. aircraft order to avoid Russian fighter aircraft in Syria, not the other way around. He's on Twitter at Senator John McCain. That's S-E-N, John McCain. Our Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb, also sent out a tweet quoting McCain. She wrote, Senator McCain hyphen, Putin bombs U.S.-backed opposition groups in Syria, and the U.S. does nothing. This is not just harmful to our interests, it is immoral. That's all for me today. Steve?
And many thanks to you, G. G. Abby Lee, our social media correspondent. You know, you can follow G on Twitter. Her handle is at G. Abby Lee. And you can also follow International Edition on Twitter. Our handle, VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that afflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. The European Union on Thursday took measures to tighten up its porous external borders and toughen up its migrant return program in an attempt to build a credible refugee policy. The EU, the 28 member nations, committed to speed up and intensify deportation of people who do not qualify for asylum, including more special flights out and detention for those who might slip in. Illegal residents. More than 500,000 people have arrived this year so far seeking sanctuary or jobs. Well, the refugee crisis has been described by many as the largest since World War II, but is that an accurate comparison? Pamela Ballinger is a University of Michigan historian and an expert on refugees as well as human rights and displacement. She speaks with VOA's Joda Capua now about the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees to Europe and how it compares to the Second World War.
I think that for Europe, in terms of the magnitude, it certainly is the largest refugee crisis since World War II, but Europe has also experienced, as we know, a number of significant refugee crises since World War II, particularly the Hungarian refugee crisis and the refugee flows produced by the wars in Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Probably in terms of numbers, this is the largest, but it depends on how you want to reckon magnitude. This perhaps is impacting the most countries within Europe at the same moment, also makes it seem like a greater emergency. But certainly the crisis after World War II was much larger, and actually I think it's important to keep that in mind in order to put what's going on now in perspective.
It's also, I guess, important to keep in mind that Europe was a shambles after World War II, so conditions were a lot different, no?
Right, of course. And that's the thing is, although Europe is still struggling with the effects of the Great Recession at the moment, as you say, after 1945, so much of continental Europe was actually in ruins. And some people estimate that on Victory Europe Day, there were as many as 11 million displaced persons in Europe. So that gives some pause to think about when people say that Europe is at its limits and can't absorb anymore. Actually, the magnitude of the crisis was so much higher in 1945, and Europe was in very devastated conditions to deal with the refugee problem then.
I also know that you look into the human rights aspects of refugee crises, and we're hearing a number of countries opposing the required quotas for the resettlement of refugees. Hungary seems to be leading the way. What does this tell you about this ongoing crisis?
Well, it reminds us that, unfortunately, many declarations and conventions on human rights are ultimately non-binding. They rely upon good faith or pressure of certain kinds, but they're very difficult to enforce at the international level when countries who have signed on to those agreements decide that they don't want to honor them in practice. But I think there is a groundswell, obviously, around the understanding and notion of human rights. And I think the flip side of the negative responses of a country like Hungary, the official level, are the grassroots efforts that many Europeans have undertaken to assist refugees. I think here we see many Europeans have a very deep commitment to the idea of human rights and see it as central to the identity of the European Union and to the post-1945 Europe. And so I think it's important to remember that there are many in Europe who really are working in the name of the human rights of these displaced persons who are coming into Europe.
Let me ask you about the impact of the refugee flows. First, let me ask you about the negative effects of the inflow. What do you see happening?
Unfortunately, I haven't been in Europe myself since June, but certainly the impacts in the first instance, you have an acute humanitarian crisis, right? There's a kind of organizational, logistical problem that is created. How do we care for these people? How do we provide them with immediate services, food, water, housing, and so on? Then there's the larger question of settling these refugees. How do you integrate them into economic and cultural systems, social systems that are very different from the ones in which they came? And then even when there's goodwill, then the political question, you know, so we're seeing this now with the criticism of Merkel. Merkel has put Germany at the forefront of the European countries willing to take refugees, but of course she faces political opposition at home because, as usually happens, domestic constituencies say, well, we have our own problems. Why are we dedicating these resources to others?
Could the refugees actually help Europe?
Oh, I think so. One can think of them as a resource. They need workers of particular kinds. And one of the things that I've been struck by in the coverage of this crisis, we see so many not only articulate refugees who've been interviewed, but refugees who are extremely fluent in English and other European languages. Many of them have linguistic resources that already will facilitate at least their integration.
Pamela Ballinger is with the University of Michigan. She's a historian, and she was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. Also in the news, South Sudan's leader says he will repartition the country into 28 states. That would be up from the current 10. Opponents say taking such unilateral action is a violation of the recently signed peace deal. We get more now from VOA's Jill Craig.
President Salva Kiir says splitting South Sudan into 28 states will help reduce the size of the national government and distribute more resources to the rural population. But rebel leader and ousted vice president Riek Machar says the president should have consulted the opposition first, per the terms of a peace agreement signed in August to end nearly 2 years of fighting. Machar spoke with VOA's Straight Talk Africa host Shaka Sali on Wednesday.
We ourselves in SPLM-SPLA declared 21 states, and we tabled this at the negotiations. We wanted to resolve this matter once and for all, but he was not ready.
He rejected it.
He rejected it. Even the mediators were on his side. They rejected it. Now we're surprised. 5 days ago, he made this declaration.
The European Union delegation to South Sudan and the Troika countries of Norway, the United Kingdom, and the United States are urging President Kiir to wait for a permanent constitution before constructing new states. But Zakaria Ding, senior policy analyst with the Sud Institute in Juba, says Kiir doesn't have to wait.
You have the government of the Republic of South Sudan, which has a president, and the party that is in power right now, that can make decisions on the country. Until the transition government is in place, I think it is far-fetched to say that there was a need on the part of the president to consult Mr. Machar at this point.
South Sudan gained independence from Sudan in 2011 after decades of civil war. However, war erupted anew in December 2013 after President Kiir's dismissal of his then-deputy Machar. According to the Council on Foreign Relations, the conflict has killed tens of thousands of people and internally displaced more than 1.6 million. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And what do you think the most listened to music is in South Africa? Would it be R&B like many other African countries, or maybe pop music like many parts of the world? Well, it turns out that a research by the international entertainment company Havas Sports and Entertainment has yielded what for some South Africans is a surprising result. Here's Darren Taylor.
The sounds of American R&B superstar R. Kelly wash over patrons at a local bar. Many people here in Johannesburg think they know what the most listened to music genre in South Africa is.
I would definitely say house music.
I would also say house music, but there's also a lot of R&B and hip-hop. If you go into any club, you'd see there's a lot of hip-hop.
The most popular music that people are listening in South Africa mostly now is house, eh? House music. The best selling is deep house.
House, and then the traditional music.
But few correctly identified the country's most popular music.
Mostly these days, people are becoming more spiritual, so they like gospel music.
The international entertainment company Havas Sports and Entertainment surveyed thousands of music lovers all over the world. It found that 13% of South Africa's population enjoys listening to Christian gospel songs, more than three times the global average of 4%. Among pedestrians in Johannesburg, the overwhelming reaction to the survey's results is one of astonishment.
That's pretty surprising.
I would have never expected that, no.
But music historian Evans Nechivambe says he could easily have predicted that gospel would emerge tops.
Most South Africans, they're very religious. Christians, if I may say. There's religious people, the music that they can relate to, it's gospel music.
He says another reason for gospel's popularity here is historical. It was used as a voice against apartheid.
Most black people found gospel music as the best way of expression of how they can tell the world who they are, you know, how they feel about their lives and what they've gone through.
In time, we'll live in peace for a world.
Much of modern South African gospel, like this track from Judith Sepuma, rails against ills such as violent crime. And, as Nechivambe says, South Africans, influenced by decades of gross inequality in their society, love a good protest. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And for more on what's happening in Africa and elsewhere, you can check out our website at voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Greek olive oil is considered among the best in the world, and the country is a top producer, but distribution is a problem. Yorgos Dimitriadis is the director of Veolia Farm in Crete.
We never learned how to compete in international market, and now that other people have that already, they're not going to open up the door and say, welcome in.
Greece does not have large processing plants or storage facilities for olive oil, so it sells a lot of its oil to Italian producers who put on their own label, ship it abroad, and make more money. Chloe Dimitriadis manages the Veolia Farm.
There's a huge potential, especially in the agricultural sector, that people, especially young people, haven't tapped into.
Financial problems in Greece have left farmers demanding cash for their goods, which slows down business. And half of the olive growers in Greece are small-scale farmers with little commercial expertise. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for being with us today. You know, renowned jealous Yo-Yo Ma, well, he celebrates his 60th birthday this month and has a new CD that makes a musical contemplative look at life. And as International Edition's David Byrd tells us now, Ma has teamed up with his longtime piano collaborator, Catherine Scott, to produce a recording that takes listeners on an emotional journey.
There are few accolades that Yo-Yo Ma has not received in his storied career. A multiple Grammy winner, Ma has also been a Kennedy Center honoree, has been awarded the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom, and has won the U.S. National Medal of Arts. On his new CD, Songs from the Arc of Life, the cellist uses classical pieces by Bach, Debussy, Tchaikovsky, and others to take listeners through several emotional ages. Ma says his intent was to record a soundtrack for life's most important moments.
Everybody goes through hard times, good times. And when you go through any one of those times, extreme moments, there's usually some music associated with it. You know, first date, first kiss, you know. It's like moments where, or grief, first loss. And so we kind of compiled something that goes from beginning to end. And to acknowledge that no matter how focused we are at any moment in our lives, that it is part of a larger whole, and how in the end do we want that life to be?
The cellist says that turning 60 is an important milestone for him. but it also gives him the freedom to be who he really is and not someone that other people want him to be.
I don't live compartments. I'm basically always myself. You know, it's not like, okay, I have to be really polite or I have to do this. No, I'll just say what I think is true and do what I think is right and not worry about, you know, someone saying, well, that's stupid, you know, because, okay, if you think it's stupid, you know, I can't help it. You know, it's like, I'm just going to try and do my best.
Yo-Yo Ma has been playing the cello since he was only 4. His parents were both musical. His mother was a singer and his father a violinist and professor of music. Despite the exacting demands of playing the classical repertoire, Yo-Yo Ma says that he actually finds serenity in playing, even the difficult pieces.
So I view sort of performing like the moments before you fall asleep or right when you wake up, and you're sort of half, you're half dreaming, half awake, and you have these great ideas that come to your mind and you try and write them down, because if you don't, you forget them because you have temporary access. And having that access puts you in this very, very wonderful state.
Yo-Yo Ma and Catherine Scott will perform in Japan and Taiwan in October and November in support of the new CD. U.S. stops on their tour include the Palladium in Carmel, Indiana, and Boston's Symphony Hall. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
I mean, could he be 60 years old? Amazing, huh? One other item from the world of music, entertainer Selena Gomez has revealed that she's battling the debilitating immune system disorder lupus. 23-year-old told Billboard magazine in an interview that she is undergoing chemotherapy. We wish her the best. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America. Good to have you with us for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes Mozambique's recent announcement that it has completed clearance of all known fields of landmines in the country. Since 1993, when Mozambique emerged from decades of conflict as one of the world's most landmine-affected nations, the United States has been proud to partner with the people of Mozambique, investing more than $55 million toward improving the safety and security of local communities through the U.S. Conventional Weapons Destruction Program. Through that partnership, which includes the international donor community and humanitarian demining organizations, we have worked diligently to safely clear landmines and unexploded ordnance, prevent injuries through community outreach and education, and provide medical and social services to survivors of accidents involving these legacies of past conflicts. The United States is proud to be the world's leading provider of financial and technical assistance to help countries address this serious humanitarian challenge. Since 1993, we have invested approximately $2.5 billion in aid in more than 90 countries to decrease the threat posed by landmines and explosive remnants of war. Our efforts have dramatically reduced the world's annual landmine casualty rate and helped 16 countries declare themselves landmine-free. Humanitarian demining in places like Mozambique sets the stage for post-conflict recovery and development. It is another important way in which the United States promotes international peace and security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.